These are the people at the heart of racing. Their lives, their stories, in their own words.
Yeah, racing. I mean, that's where it started, Michael. That's really the beginning. That's where it burned as a kid.
We'll talk about the champion, Black Caviar.
Black Caviar was a freak. So was the trainer.
No, the first Melbourne Cup I was involved with was a horse called Gutum Gutum.
Gutum Gutum.
I was listening to an RSN interview with John Hawkes, and he said, I think it's a really average guineas this year.
This is a very sad story, but making sure that, you know, that his head was upright.
See TJ Smith or Bart Cummings in the background, and you're just in awe.
Follow a lot of sports, but the sport I'll follow most closely will be horse racing.
For the next hour, RSN 927's Racing Pulse presents Racing's Open Mic.
And it is great to have live in the studio for Racing's Open Mic today, Nigel Blackister. Nigel, how are you?
Very well, Michael, and good morning to you.
Bringing back memories when we were talking about the Blue Diamond, you were a pivotal part of the great Bart Cummings team. We're going to talk about some of the great horses he had, but the Blue Diamond win, Riva Diva, back around about 1990, 1991?
91, I think she was. She's a nice filly owned by the Haynes family, and she was a little bit of a madam when she first arrived. She was a little bit unruly, but I seemed to click with her quite well, and she ended up winning 5 races straight for us.
It's amazing. No, you've had such a varied career so far, and a new chapter is about to unfold with the move to Ballarat. We'll talk about that in a moment as well. But tell us where it all began for you with your family and how you got the bug for racing.
I got the bug when we moved to Newmarket in 1977. I was born just outside London. The folks moved there through my father's work, and I just got a part-time job and just fell in love with it. I worked with a guy called Bruce Hobbs, who was the youngest man ever to win the Grand National at the age of 17, and on the only stallion, a horse called Battleship in 1939.
And so your dad or your mum didn't have any racing involvement. It was just literally moving to Newmarket. What did your dad do?
Dad was a sales rep for the Phillips Electrical Company. He always loved racing. He was brought up in Surrey near Epsom Downs, and he's always laughed. He enjoys $2 bets and everything else through his life, and we used to go to the races obviously as children with him, and enjoyed the experience, but never been near a horse until I moved to Newmarket.
Yeah, wow. And most people would find it hard to believe because you're not a short man, but you actually had a crack at riding for a while.
I did, yes. Ended up being an apprentice after being, I used to go there weekends and school holidays and everything else, and I signed on as an apprentice jockey. Had one ride, put 3.5 pound overweight up, and the boss said, I think we better change your direction, which way we're going in the racing game for you. Obviously, you're going to be too tall and too heavy.
So you only had the one ride?
One ride, yes.
How did you go?
Finished 10th of a field of 20, and we had Willie Carson, Steve Cawthon,
wow,
Pat Edgery, all the major jockeys were either side of me. So, yes, it went that quick, I can't remember it.
That's pretty amazing, though, to have those absolute legends of the riding world that you would have been sharing the room with, and obviously track work and everything as well.
Well, the most embarrassing part was trying to find a pair of boots to fit my feet. That was the hardest thing.
But you still do a bit of work today, though, don't you?
Yes, I love riding. Always have done. I think I'm a horseman, and I still get on the horses pretty much most mornings these days, right about 4 or 5, and I love it. It's great.
I often ask people, is being a horseman something that's innate or learned? Do you think that some people have a disposition that they get on and have a more of an affinity with the animal, or is it something that you learn over time?
I think it's a little bit of both, but I think you certainly need to have an affinity with the animal. You've got to have a health respect. And it's all about feel. I mean, if a horse wants to take off, it doesn't matter if you're a 100-stone or a 10-stone person, they can just take charge. And it's having that confidence and having the know-how when to push the right sort of buttons and everything else and get the right feel of the animal. And just keep it comfortable, and I've always been a big believer of using your voice, talk to them, keep them calm and keep them relaxed as much as you can.
At the end of the day, for trainers like yourself, is it the love of the animal that is the number one reason that pulls you into the sport and keeps you in the sport?
Certainly for me, it's always been the love of the animal. I mean, I love my dogs, love my cats, and we're very sort of pet-orientated family, myself and my wife Susanna. The horse for me is the number one thing. I mean, they're just a beautiful creature, and just struck it off with them from day one.
Mm. And are you still learning every day?
Oh, you do. They never stop. There's always something different that rears its head, whether it's in a good way or a bad way. And you just got to, be mindful of how you go around it and try and get the best out of each animal you possibly can.
So after your time at Newmarket, your failed jumps career, or your failed jockey career, I should say, where did you get the inspiration to become a trainer from? Is that what you were always looking to become?
Not straight away. I was very lucky enough to be invited by a close friend of mine, a guy called Bill Mather, to go to Dubai in 1986. And no one'd ever heard of Dubai then.
What was Dubai like then?
It was like, it was fantastic. I mean, it was very new and obviously had old parts of the city. Some of the new parts with the high-rise buildings were going up. I mean, obviously now it's like the Gold Coast on steroids. It's just gone viral in a big way. But, you know, we were there pre-training in the hope they were going to start racing, but unfortunately it never happened in my time. Sheikh Maktoum was the main person behind it at the time. He was the oldest son of the Crown Prince and the rulers of Dubai. And he was taken ill, went to England for a while, and it sort of simmered for a couple of years. So I thought, I'm missing the racing. Do I stay here and hope it takes off, go back to England, or venture across to Australia? And we come to Australia.
So with that, at that time over in Dubai, it was planned for it to become the racing centre that it is now. So what were you doing over there before it was getting off the ground?
We were just having these horses sent over from all over the world, England, Ireland, America, in the hope that they were going to be racing. We pre-trained them during the winter months. We took them quiet and just trotted and hacked around in the summer months. And just, you know, for 4 years, we were just hoping. And at that time, Dubai wasn't clear of the disease, African horse sickness. So it was a one-way ticket for them. So a lot of the horses at that time ended up going to the equestrian centre next door, which was much bigger. They had a lot more events going on for them. So they ended up being show jumpers or three-day event horses and all those sort of things. And that's frustrating for me because I did miss the racing. I had a lovely time. It's like being on holiday for 4 years. We're well looked after. But, you know, I'm a racing person. It's in the blood and I want to do more racing.
Did you have much to do with all the guys over there now who are the main people involved in the racing? How much contact did you have with the sheikhs that were trying to get racing up and running?
Look, my main contact, we used to go to what we call the Majlis, which is their meeting place every Friday. That was the weekend. And we go and sit there, and it could be anything between 100 to 200 local people, as well as myself and my boss, Bill. We're the only English people sitting there waiting. And if the sheikh wanted to talk to you, he summoned you over and you discuss things. And the good thing about the Dubai and Arabs, they always say yes. And it might take a year, it might take a couple of weeks before it happens, but it will happen.
Must have been a fascinating period of your life to be over and experience all of that.
It was fantastic. I mean, as a 21, 20-year-old going across there, leaving England home at that time and having the experience of being, especially in the summertime, it was a little bit warm. But we would say it was air conditions, we looked after with cars and apartments, with memberships to the country club, and we used to water ski every Friday. It's just a great time. But, it's just... It can be a little bit of a false world sometimes. And coming back, we moved to Australia, certainly brought us back to reality very quickly.
Well, why did you choose to come to Australia?
I'd obviously done, grew up in England. I thought, challenge of coming somewhere different. Always remember my mum and dad always speaking about going to Australia themselves. They'd love to have gone there and tried it. So I thought we'd have a look and see. And the plan was to stay for a couple of years. Bart Cummings invited me to come over and join him for 2 years and sponsor me. He renewed it for two more years, and then it sort of grew from there.
So how did that relationship with Bart start?
When I was thinking of shifting across here, I sent out several letters to different trainers. John Hawks, I sent a letter to him, Armin Asco at Caulfield, and Bart sort of come back and said, look, if you'd like to come across, have a chat, we can organise visas and everything like that for you. So, you know, he knew what to do, and it all sort of fell in place from there.
So what year was that when you came over to Bart's?
1990.
Okay, so that was probably around the period, just around the period that Bart was having the financial trouble with
it? We sort of turned up, and obviously I hadn't heard it before we arrived here, that he was going through the financial trouble, the stock market crash and everything else. And but lucky for us that Kingston were all coming along that time.
Well, so many good horses. So what was it like when you walked into Bart's stable, who was already a legend of Australian racing then, and he's a quirky type of character who doesn't say too much publicly, but what was he like as a young kid coming over here to work with?
Well, I found him very fair. I mean, I first went to Sydney for 3 months. Leon Corson was his foreman here in Melbourne and been so for 20 plus years. Mm. And he hadn't had a holiday for a long time, so Bart wanted to send him away on long service leave. So he said, well, you go down and just sort of settle in there for a few weeks and look after the stable while Leon goes away, which I did. And, at the time, leading into the spring carnival in the House of Kingston Raw, and that was great. And then Let's Lope come along afterwards the following year.
Unbelievable period. Could you believe the horses that you were getting to work with?
Oh, it was amazing. I mean, just obviously, you know, being a bit quiet, having a few Melbourne Cup runners prior to the 90s, and all of a sudden we had two or three in a row. It's incredible.
I spoke a lot to Joe Agresta on the program about some of those horses, and Kingston Rule, he was telling us about the work that Bart wanted to put into the horse, and sometimes they might have disagreed with that, but Bart seemed to be just a step ahead when it came to the training routines as well. Was that what you were feeling with Bart? Did you ever question some of his methods and then at the end of the day go, he always knew what he was doing?
No, I don't ever question. The only thing I did change once, and we can talk about that afterwards, is Saintly is one thing I did change once. Mm. When he first come down after he'd run in the Metropolitan and everything else, and for me he was a little bit of a tired horse.
Because he was disappointing in the Metropolitan.
Yeah, but he'd done a lot of miles lead into the Metropolitan. I just went a little bit quiet off the pony for a couple of extra days rather than give him that gallop in between, and just to try and freshen him a little bit more, because he certainly looked, he was a very flat horse when he first come down.
What about Let's Alone?
She was just amazing. When she came off the truck from the airport, I mean, she's a big, powerful, plain-looking chestnut mare, mare at the time, and just kept ringing up Bart and said, God, this thing can eat, so we'll keep feeding it, and it could eat and eat, and just cope with the work and everything else. But one thing, she did not like a wet track.
Yeah.
Couldn't go a yard.
Did you know she was going to be as good as she was when she first came into the stable? Was she a horse that took you by surprise?
Well, not for me. It's obviously only my second year here, and we were lucky enough to get King's Rule, but to try and understand, you know, you look back on what she actually did, you can appreciate it later years, what she was, how good she was and what she could do. And, you know, to win the Caulfield Cup, the Melbourne Cup, the Australian Cup and many other group races in a period of 2 years, you know, she was a very good mare.
Was she the best, or was Saintly the best that you think you had something to do with at Bart's?
I love Saint, because Saintly, I was on my own with him. I was in charge of the stable at the time. Possibly he's one of the greatest ones I've seen him, and didn't see the best of him, but the horse I hold the softest spot for was Shaftesbury Avenue. He was just a beauty.
He was a phenomenal horse and a beautiful looking animal as well. Tell me about what Shaftesbury was to you and why you think he was the best horse that you had something to do with.
Well, he's just his pure nature. He's just a real kind, gentleman of a horse. He just wanted to please you the whole time, and to win at over 1,000, win a Doncaster, win a Newmarket, win a Caulfield Stakes, and very unlucky not to run a Japan Cup, to have that versatility from 1,000 metres to 1.5 miles. Not too many horses can do that.
Now, unbelievable. Did you get to go to Japan with him?
No, I didn't. No, Joe and Leon went with him, because Leon was in charge of him at the time, and you know, he's just to be part of that stable and have him around was just fantastic.
Do you still look back on those days and use some of the practices that Bart did, or is his training style?
Coming from England, going to Dubai, and obviously spending 29 years in Australia, obviously I try and amalgam all those ideas into certain parts of certain horses. They're all individual. Some things would suit other horses up better than what others do. But yes, I mean, obviously Bart was a hard worker, big feeder. Time to change a little bit. The European horses coming across, I don't think we can work them as hard. And they've got a lot more brilliance about them. So the old days of the good old-fashioned handicapper have gone.
What style of horse do you prefer? Or you can't afford to have a certain style, just anything?
Oh, I love horses that can win, Mike, I'll be honest with you.
Don't we all?
The ones he wants.
What type of horses do you, if you're looking at a catalogue, are you looking to get horses, are you drawn to a particular type of horse?
Obviously for myself, I mean, I'd like to try and get more precocious type of horses, but they're possibly at the higher end, the better ones, the higher end of the budget I can afford. So I try and aim for sort of mile plus, mile and a quarter, mile and a half sort of horses. They come more into our budgets, and they give you a little bit more diversity as well, because you get those real precocious two-year-olds, they might only be here for one season. Where if you get a nice old-fashioned welter, handicap sort of horse that you can build up over the years, you might be racing just 5, 6, 7, hopefully.
You've had plenty of good horses over the time, but I imagine Latorio would hold a very special place in your heart, because he gave you your first Group 1, isn't that right?
He did,
Turnbull Stakes Day at Flemington. Yeah. Let's relive it.
He's hit the go button on Weekend Hustler. He's not responding at the moment. In fact, Latourio's gone past him. Pompey Ruler out after Maldivian. Here comes Latourio. And down the outside, Maestro Riley. Latourio getting to Pompey Ruler. Maestro Riley and zipping running on. But Latourio takes the lead and draws away. Latourio by a length and a half, Maestro Riley. Zipping might have got third from...
Gee, was a good horse for you. And you must have been wondering, when is the day going to come for my first Group 1? He'd been placed in the... in the Victoria Derby, the AJC Derby, the Rose Hill Guineas, so many good races, the Underwood Stakes beforehand. Were you getting frustrated at the time?
No, I wasn't frustrated. I mean, obviously, I thought he could possibly win the Victorian Derby, but it's one of those situations where it wasn't to be on the day, and he's always a big, raw horse and just slowly kept growing to himself and developing. I mean, he was 17-3, he was a beast. You can see him at home now. I see him every day. And
Is he with you? He is.
He's a big horse. And he's just one of those horses. Once he got wound up, he's an amazing turn of foot, and he could sustain that for a long time.
For a trainer who's spent their whole life in the racing game, what does that first Group 1 mean?
It's great. It puts you up there with some of the greater, you know, the better trainers you're competing with. And to have that Group 1 behind your name, it's what we all dream about.
Does it make things easier? It's such a tough caper. People talk about putting your name up in lights, but does winning a big race or having a good horse necessarily mean that you're going to get more horses and more owners?
I'd have to say no on that one, Michael. We've still got to work very hard. I've got some very loyal owners with me, and they've been with me for a long time, but possibly not everyone's cup of tea, and you just got to keep working on it, and hopefully... better horses come along, and also it's up to myself as well when I go to the sales, trying to pick the right horse as well.
It's what all trainers say is most difficult is trying to get horses and paid for, having owners. Do you go to sales and buy on spec and try to fill those horses, or do you try to have your owners ready to go?
Over the last couple of years, we've trying to buy, spend a bit more money if possible. I've got the owners together beforehand. I won't go and buy and spec because I think it's possibly a case of suicide at this stage. If you try and go, and especially with the market the way it is, if I haven't got pretty much most of the horse covered, I won't buy it.
So what market did you say you're looking at for a horse? Between the 100,000, 200,000, is it?
It's pretty much our market, yes. I went in New Zealand a couple of years ago. We tried to extend it a little bit more, but got knocked off by the Hong Kong Jockey Club. But I had some good people behind me that were willing to go that a little bit further.
How difficult is it trying to compete, especially for the owners and at the sales?
Well, especially with the sort of budget you have, you've got there's so many of us in that sort of league that are trying to compete for the same horses. And it can also push the prices up. I mean, we can all go and pick the best pedigree on page and the best types. If you've got that sort of money to buy them, we can all buy them. Mm. The $1 million horses are easy to find, but try and find the ones in that lesser bracket, nice style of horse, with a nice family and everything else. They're the ones we're all trying to find, the athlete of those sort of horses.
You had a Group 1 winner come your way a few years after that, and she was a great mare, Suave Vito. And she had a great affinity at Caulfield, and she had a great period in her career.
Mourinho entirely platinum. Svavito is getting through. Lucky Hustler still in traffic, and so is Bow Creek on the rail. Turn me loose, 150 to go. He's a length and a half. Svavito gets out and runs on, and here's Hucklebuck coming now. Svavito got to the lead. Svavito in front of Rebel Dane. Turn me loose. Svavito wins it. Lucky Hustler flew. He was unlucky. Close for
that was her winning the 2016 CFL Stakes, and in that period, she won the Tessio, she won a Group 2 race at Flemington, she won the Group 1 Futurity and the Blamey. She then ran 7th, not beaten far in the Doncaster, came back and won the CFL Stakes and finished 3rd in the Futurity. What a stellar period of her career that was.
It was a great time, and when she first turned up in the stables, Michael, she was a little weedy, plain little bay filly with a lot of temperament, but just had one of the amazing toughness and tenacity you'll see in any horse.
Is she your mum yet? Is she?
Yes, her first foal was sold this year in New Zealand for $775,000.
Just a little bit out of your range?
Just a little bit, by Zavabil. And he was a ripper for a foal as well, for first foal. He wasn't overly big, but he was nice conformation and a nice type. And she's got, I believe, two more Zavabils coming through.
Yeah. Do you think she'll make it?
I think so. If she can put into her offspring what she had, definitely.
Nigel Blackston's my special guest in Studio Racing's Open Mic. We're going to take a break. On the other side, I want to have a chat to Nigel about the next chapter, his period, the move to Ballarat, and also how tough it is at the moment with the trainers, the feed costs, and also the level playing field here in Victoria.
This is RSN 927's Racing Pulse and Open Mic.
And Nigel Blackiston's my guest on Racing's Open Mic. And Nigel, this is a busy week for you because you are making the move to Ballarat, leaving Flemington, which has been your home for so many years, and a new chapter. How excited are you about that? And logistically, what's it mean? How big's the move?
The move's obviously a big deal, Michael. Obviously, you've got to shift all the gear and the staff and the horses, but that will all fall in place over the next couple of days. And Monday next week will be my last day of working at Flemington. Once we've fixed the horses up and they're comfortable, we will load them up on the trucks and head up to Ballarat.
So where you'll be at Ballarat, is it part of what Darren Weir's old complex used to be?
No, it's up. Part of his complex in one way is where he had his pre-trained horses. It's just behind the grandstand of the main stand of the racecourse. 32 boxes, got a walker, got a treadmill, it's got day yards. It's just a really nice complex and a good setup that Lachlan McKenzie's offered to myself and my staff, and looking forward to it. It's a new chapter, a new challenge, and I've been at Flemington for 23 years now, and I think it's time to have a change.
Well, you've been looking at this for a couple of years, and I suppose the Darren Weir situation has basically accelerated it.
It has. I mean, I've been talking to Lachlan for about 18 months now. He's invited me out a couple of times and said that they can offer this, that we're going to build me a whole brand new complex, which took in a year. And then he said that Darren was going to move his pre-training horses to his Maldon property. This could come available in a couple of weeks' time. And obviously what happened over the last couple of weeks certainly accelerates a lot quicker than we had planned. It's all falling into place nicely now.
Why Ballarat? I know a lot of people have been raving about the facilities. Why have you decided to make the move there?
It's certainly a very big and progressive club. It's certainly, for my personal choice, it's more about the horse. There's a bit more open space, a lot more diversity in training. I know Flemington are putting in a brand new training track for the trainers there. What's going to happen in the next 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years down the track? And I think where Ballarat is well established, I just like the environment for the horses. It's more outside. It's got the uphill track. There's talk of putting the grass uphill track as well. They're putting the new poly track down to train and race on. It's going ahead, and hopefully it will be a better place to staff as well.
You mentioned staff, and that has been a perennial factor when we speak to trainers, trying to get good staff. What's it been like for you and other trainers at Flemington?
I'd have to say over the last 2, maybe 3 years, it's got a lot harder, especially with good skilled horse people coming through. They're not there anymore, and they're not being taught coming through the apprentice school. I think personally they should take on a lot more than they do, or go back to the old way where the trainer can have an apprentice and then maybe filter through the apprentice school when they get to a certain level and they take them under their wing then. But how it is at the moment, they ain't taking on maybe a dozen or half a dozen each year. What happens to those ones that don't become jockeys? They could become good track riders, and the money track riders can earn at the moment for maybe 3, 4 hours each morning, 6 days a week, you can earn a good living, and they're just not coming through the industry. I think the government needs to allow overseas experienced horse people to come into the country a bit more on working visas, and it would help. But the situation at the moment, it's just getting harder and harder, and I think most trainers out there are struggling for staff.
So do you think it'll be easier to staff based at Ballarat?
I think being back into the country environment, I believe there's more horse people out there. I've had 2 or 3 phone calls since the announcement I'm going there that people are looking for work. It's all been well. It will be.
And you're in a lucky situation that the majority of your staff are happy to relocate with you.
They are. They've still got a very good assistant trainer and her partner, Chris, who's her head lad, and they're English. And I sponsor them. They're happy to do the shift because at the moment they're in the position of applying for permanent residence, which hopefully will help. And a couple of the other ground staff are happy to come as well, which is, for me, doing that transition of moving and having the same staff come with me is fantastic.
Where do you see the future of training? Do you believe that it will be these regional hubs? We know Caulfield's shutting down. We know that there's a new 5-year lease on the table at Flemington, but beyond that, the VRC has spoken openly about the trainers will be moved eventually. We've got the hub at Ballarat. We've got a hub being built down at Pakenham. We've got the Cranbourne Training Centre there. And I know Amanda Elliott, the chairman of the Race Victoria, has VRC, has said on numerous occasions that they would love to see a training complex or centre developed by Racing Victoria out around Oaklands Junction or somewhere like that. Is that what you see the future being for training?
It's definitely the way training's going. And it'd be fantastic if the infrastructure was down now from the VRC that they are going to build something, or land was brought and they were putting plans in to do this. I mean, I possibly wouldn't make me rethink about Ballarat if that was the case, but it's not happening. It's talk at the moment. It needs to be done and get going, push forward a bit quicker. Because, yes, I think training on course in the city is gradually getting squeezed out for whatever reasons they have. I think it's easier to have concerts and other functions going on the course, more beneficial to having horses trained there. And I can understand the reason. You know, for me, taking the horses away from the city is better. I think going back to, say, the country environment, letting them be horses, giving them more space to work around in, and having more diversity of where we can work them, it's important.
What are the other trainers' thoughts? You would talk to them every morning out at Flemington about their future and what it's like to be training in town?
I think possibly most trainers do seem to have their own farms, or like the Hawks team, they've got different stables they can shift a horse around. They get that diversity of moving things around. Hayes Camp's got the big training complex up near Seymour, and as well as the city base. So they got that comfort of having those different diversities already. But the smaller stables like myself, I mean, I think, you know, it needs to be put into plan that we know where we're going in, say, the next 5-10 years.
Cost is a huge factor as well. What's it cost to train at Flemington, your rent and so forth, compared to a regional centre like Ballarat?
With the new leases, I won't sort of put what price it is. The rent is going up. And hence, if the rent's going up, I've got to run into my clients with their increase. I've got to increase them as well. But by moving to Ballarat at this stage, I can maintain my training fees of what they are, and there won't be an increase. But obviously, the drought's a big impact. Feed prices are going up. And once they go up, very rarely they come back down again. And it's getting harder and harder. But if you look what I charge 120 a day. What we do in that horse in that 120 a day, people pay $200, $250 just for a bed in the hotel.
$120 a day. We're going to have a chat to Andrew Nicol in a moment, who's the boss of the Trainers Association, and the feed situation, the drought situation is very high on the list of what most people are talking about at the moment. But what's the average price for a trainer these days in town?
In town, I think between, I'd say, $110 to $130
yep.
a day.
Of $120 a day, how tight is that for you with overheads?
The biggest cost, obviously, is wages, feed and rent. They're the three biggest things. So very small margin to make a profit on just general training fees. You need to get winners, and that's the biggest thing.
And how much have you noticed it's becoming tighter with the feed cost increase and the issues from the drought?
It's becoming a big problem. And you can see your margins are getting smaller and smaller, especially in a smaller stable like myself that, you know, we sit around 25, 30. We need to have those heads in those boxes every day to keep, you know, to pay the rent, to pay the staff, to pay the feed man. It's so important. And also we carry so many other things as well. We pay the farrier. Some trainers pay the vets and everything else and carry that cost across. So the more we have to carry, you know, and people operate on 60, 90 days, it can be slow coming back into your account.
And what's the reaction like from your owners? How much do they understand any increase that you may pass on?
Look, I'm very lucky that, you know, one or two may whinge at the time and complain about these things, but overall they understand. A lot of my clients come down and see how much work we put into the horse each day and how much effort goes into having been a trainer. And it's not all roses, but, you know, the rewards at the end of it, if you get the right sort of horses, you get the Torios, the Suavitos and the good horses come through, then yes, the rewards are very good.
Well, Andrew Nicol's going to join us now because he's the boss of the Trainers Australian Trainers Association, who yesterday probably put out an unusual statement saying that publicly they are encouraging trainers to increase their fees because of the increased cost of feed. Andrew joins us now. How are you, Andrew?
Good, thanks, Michael.
How's this been received by trainers, but also have you had much feedback from owners who potentially will have to bear this extra cost?
Yeah, there's been a lot of feedback, Michael, and I guess just to qualify the point you made, it's really recommending that trainers look at their financial model at the moment and particularly look around it with what's happening in that drought area with feed. Obviously, we think, you know, personal view is the pure statistics show that the cost of feed has risen between $2 and $4 per horse per day, and that's just based around the last 8 months. We've had significant drought across the country. It started in New South Wales. It's broadened beyond the borders now to Queensland and the northern parts of Victoria, and that's had a staggering effect on crop yields. And in turn, if you've got 25% less stock, there's only one way for it to go, and that's up, because price will drive it that way. So whilst we believe that there's justification for increase in those prices, what we really wanted to do was make everybody aware of the problem, because some people have an issue in terms of how they commence that dialogue. So we wanted to put it out in the public domain. We wanted to raise awareness to it, and we wanted to show the statistics. And the statistics are that the cost is increasing. It's increasing at an alarming rate. And more importantly, the future, what do we see for the next 12 months? Because if the rainfall patterns stay the same, then, you know, we might be moving into uncharted waters.
We spoke about this on the show a couple of months ago, because this is an issue that's been building, as you said, for quite some time. Have you had any response now that you put out an official statement yesterday from TROWEN, the Owners Association?
No, we haven't. Obviously, we've had the anticipated, you know, response on the social media platforms. I mean, we're conscious, and Nigel will tell you the same thing. I mean, owners, the last thing owners want to see is an increase in costs. You know, it's already costs a significant sum of money to, you know, training fees to train a horse in this country, and particularly in the metropolitan area. So we're always conscious of the fact that it's a juggle between a business model or a financial model for the trainer, as well as what owners can afford. But, you know, the stark reality is that we've got a situation that is rampant and potentially is looking to get, you know, more financially difficult as the months drag on. Because as I said, this is simply in the last 8 months we've had significant increase. So, I mean, it's a difficult situation for us all. I mean, do we look at governments? Well, they're handing out money to farmers, as we know at the moment, Michael. I mean, there's well in excess of $1.25 billion $1.25 billion has been handed out to the primary producers and the farmers at the moment. You know, do we look at the PRAs? Is there something that we should be doing from that perspective? I mean, right now, the message that we are getting from everybody is that this is really a local issue to be dealt with by trainer and owner. We raise that awareness. We haven't had TROA come back to the party at this point in time. I mean, we would understand that they'd probably have a very wait-and-see position from an owner's viewpoint. I mean, they're not really going to come out and support an uplift in price, I wouldn't suspect. So we've put the facts out there, and we'll just see where that takes us.
Have you spoken to Racing Victoria or other the principal racing bodies about possible subsidisation if this continues to get worse, as is expected?
What we've done, Michael, is we have put it on the table. You know, we put it on the table with Racing Victoria, and they've very much taken a watch-and-see position. I know that the Racing New South Wales have had a conversation also with the local New South Wales Trainers Association about this. I mean, Racing New South Wales last year donated $1 million to assist trainers to the funds that were delivering hay and food around New South Wales. Obviously, that was eaten up relatively quickly, but that was their contribution at the time. I think the issue is with most of the PRAs that they're focused in other areas at the moment, but I think the important point that you make and that we make is that we've had the discussion, we've raised awareness at that level, and if it gets to a point where this exacerbates beyond where it is, it might very well be a situation where the PRAs might need to look at what they can do, what contribution they can make to trainers, so that we can support the industry far better.
It is a big issue, Andrew. I appreciate your time. From your general chat to trainers, have many taken up the advice to increase their training fees?
I think, look, a lot of the metropolitan trainers have been very conscious of this for a while, Michael. You know, they're already taken steps to, you know, to increase training fees. This, in many respects, will be more assistance to those smaller trainers, the trainers in the middle, perhaps the trainers down in the bottom areas where they find it difficult to know how to start the conversation with their owners. They're in areas which are, you know, regional areas perhaps where, you know, the owners are already struggling or already, you know, at the top end of what they can afford. So this is a tool as much as anything else to say, hey, guys, here's the data, here's the facts of the matter. So you guys, at least you've now got the information that allow you to start the conversation in the same way that a number of the larger metropolitan trainers and provincial trainers have already felt this. They've seen this coming. They've got a, you know, quite a big corporate structure. So, I mean, they're sensitive to labour costs. They're sensitive to, you know, fuel costs. They're sensitive to, you know, a change in the cost of feed. So, I mean, we know that a number of the corporate trainers have improved or increased their prices already. So this is really just a call out to everybody that is a national problem, whether you've got the one horse, whether you've got the 60 horses in your stable. So be aware of it, and to the degree that you can have that conversation, let's have that conversation.
Thanks for your time this morning, Andrew.
Good on you. Thanks, Michael.
Nigel, will you increase your training first?
Not at this stage. That's one of the reasons, say, moving to Ballarat. I can maintain what price I am now and won't have to. If I stay at Flemington with the increase of rent and obviously the fee price and everything else, yes, I'd have to.
And are most trainers talking about this, the cost of the feed as well, and how much it impinges on their profitability or their ability to train properly?
Well, yeah, yeah. If you're doing the job properly and you feed them properly, yes, it will impinge on that because, you know, fee prices keep going up, and say also wages go up as well. So you've got to keep in line with them. It's an important factor.
Nigel Blackston's my special guest. We're going to take a break on the other side of this. I want to talk about a couple of the horses Nigel's got. Maybe we'll be able to find the listeners a winner as well.
This is RSN 927's Racing Pulse and Open Mic.
Got an interesting text message coming through just off the back of the chat with Andrew Nicol from the ATA and the feed prices and possible training increases. Why can't there be a deduction from prize money allocations, first or fourth, similar to the equine and jockey welfare deductions and spread to all trainers of starters? That's from Ross. There's some merit in that. What do you think about that as a trainer, Nigel?
I think that'd be a good idea, Michael. I personally think that there should be a trust set up for the trainers. You know, especially, you know, if you're not one of the big leading trainers, I think sometimes it can be a big struggle. And in certain times of year, say, feed increase and everything else, and you can have that little bit of support from our own members, it can only be helpful.
Do you think we've got too many trainers, 800, 900 licensed trainers?
No, I don't know. If they're doing a good job and got integrity, I can't see the problem of having 1,000 trainers, but as long as they're all doing the right thing.
Is there enough to go around? Is the pie big enough?
I think so. I mean, someone's got to train that horse, whether it's a person with one horse or a person with 600 horses. We're all individual trainers. We all do things a little bit different. So hopefully, you know, there's room for everybody if they do the right thing.
It's been a tough couple of weeks for the racing industry. It's been a tough couple of years on the integrity front. What's your thoughts on where racing is situated at the moment, and do you believe it's a level playing field?
I think it's gradually becoming a more level playing field. Over the last couple of years, the stewards and the integrity board have worked very hard, and for me personally, there's no place for cheating. We've got to stamp it out, and they can continue doing what they're doing. I think it's fantastic. It can only be good for the public respect for our game. I mean, it doesn't look great headlines saying that another cheat's been caught or someone's been rubbed out, but the long-term picture, it means we're getting rid of these sort of people. We don't want them in the industry, and the more that can happen, the better the response can come from the public and the more confidence they can have.
What was your reaction when all the headlines hit the papers about the Darren Weir situation?
I'd rather not say, if you don't mind, to be honest with you. I have my own views on this. again, the integrity are doing a great job. The stewards have done a wonderful job. Great for them. I hope it continues.
For you, the future now, what's your goals? You're making the move to Ballarat. I suppose, where do you see yourself as a trainer? You've got 30 boxes there. Do you want to get bigger, or is that your niche?
No, obviously, if I got bigger with quality, yes, definitely. But if I can have 30 quality horses, my owners can have a good experience. I mean, obviously, moving to Ballarat, some of the Melbourne people have to travel out, but it's all about coming up, spending the day with us, seeing your horse work, or having to give it a pat, having some lunch and having a good time. And also, it's lifestyle for me personally and my staff. I think we can make it a little bit more comfortable. I get up at 2:30 every morning at the moment. If I can get up 4:30, those 2 extra hours will be very warranted and hopefully give me a longevity going forward as well. And, I think it's an exciting move. I think personally it's going to be better for the horses, and hopefully the owners enjoy the ride as well.
We speak about that burnout factor for trainers. 24/7 racing pretty much, nighttime racing as well. Getting up at 2:30 every day, is the burnout factor a big part of you?
Definitely. As I get older, I'm 55 at the moment. I still think I'm relatively fit and healthy, but I don't know how many more years I can keep doing it. So I've sat and discussed this with my wife on many occasions of what path we can take, and I think the direction we're taking the business, and hopefully it will work. If not, I'll find something else to do.
What else would you do?
Who knows? I'm sure there's something out there I can try my hands at.
So if you're getting up at 2:30 in the morning, what time are you going to bed?
If I'm in bed by 10 o'clock, I'm done well.
You serious?
I'm serious.
That's 4.5 hours.
Yes.
How do you function on that? That's amazing.
I'm just going to just keep going. I can live on power naps if given the opportunity. But if I'm active and doing something, I'm great. If I'm sitting behind the desk looking at paperwork, I fall asleep very quickly.
Well, let's find a winner, because that's why you do it, to get the next good horse. You got one in today at Seymour. Pure Acceleration, first up since September. Benny Allen rides. What are you thinking today?
I think he's a nice horse in the making. He's trialled well. We've gelded since last preparation. And possibly the 12 runs a fraction short, but if he's just balanced and in a good position, he'll be finishing off strongly.
He did show ability last time in as well. And I see you've got one in tomorrow at Sandown, Ladbrokes Platt. Get Him Hell, who's shown ability in the past with Geordie Childs on board. Not a bad galloper, this horse.
She's a good galloper. She got a really good first-up record and loved Geelong. She had 3 starts first-up with Geelong for 3 wins. I think Sandown, Lakeside, Hillside throw is a similar sort of track. 1,000 metres, I think she'll run perfect. I mean, she's trialled nicely and come back bigger and stronger, and I'm really pleased with her.
Looking forward to following that one tomorrow. Is there anything else in the stable that you can give the listeners to keep an eye on over the coming weeks?
I've got a nice mare called Lady of Flanders. She's been consistent, shown nice ability. I believe she can get to the States company, and but I've got to follow the rain clouds. She's no good on hard tracks.
Nige, it's been great to have you in the studio talking about your career from where it started to where it is heading. Best of luck with the move to Ballarat.
Cheers, Michael. Thank you very much.